Welcome to The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for The Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we hear from writers Jeffrey Eugenides and Danzy Senna from an onstage conversation at Wordstock, Portland's book festival, in November 2017. Eugenides is best known for his many award-winning novels, including The Virgin Suicides, Middlesex, The Marriage Plot, and the 2017 collection of new and selected stories, A Fresh Complaint. Danzy Senna is the author of the novel Caucasia and four other books of fiction and nonfiction. In the fall of 2017, she published the novel New People. Senna and Eugenides have both shown themselves to be fearless writers, whether their subject is gender, race, or sex, or other topics considered sensitive or taboo. Their books stray into the areas that can make readers feel uncomfortable and challenge assumptions. It's these characteristics that make their work so compelling. In this conversation, Senna and Eugenides talk about what it means to be artistically brave in a cultural moment when many are thinking hard about appropriation, insult, and authenticity. We hear them talk about the difference between when they are a writer and when they are an author, the ingredients that go into making their characters come alive, and why disturbing novels matter. This is a lively and engaging conversation filled with humor and insight, deftly moderated by the writer Julie Button. Let's listen.
Hi, everyone. There are a lot of people here.
It's a huge honor to be moderating this panel, and I am thrilled to be here. I've been reading both of these authors for a long time. We're actually going to start with readings from Jeffrey and Danzy, so Danzy, we'll start with you.
I'm going to read from New People, and it's a novel set in 1990s Brooklyn, and the main character is a woman named Maria, and her fiancé, Khalil, are living in a neighborhood of Fort Greene, and they've just gotten out of college, and she's writing her dissertation on the Jonestown Massacre. And she is ambivalent about the impending wedding. And both characters are biracial, and they sort of think of themselves as the king and queen of the racially nebulous prom. Maria and Khalil wander Crate and Barrel one afternoon in a dream state, making a list of the objects they hope will fill their cabinet someday. Fairly useless household items that, according to the sales lady at Crate and Barrel, are necessities of a grown-up, middle-class couple. Objects that nobody, as far as Maria can tell, uses on a daily basis, but they might someday whimsically desire and should therefore have stored away in their cabinets just in case. A Le Creuset pie pan fluted around the edges, because someday, once or twice in the next decade, she will want to bake a pie. A six-speed blender that can crush ice and probably fingers, too, in its silver blades. A crock pot with a ceramic insert that promises to make wholesome dinners while the multitasking career mother is at work. A mortar and pestle made from volcanic rock used to crush spices for the slow cooker meals she will someday prepare and leave to cook by themselves. A juicer for the fresh orange juice she will once or twice think to serve her tribe of racially nebulous children in the morning before school. A set of cocktail tumblers and a copper ice bucket for the chic parties they will do every weekend or more likely every few years. An ice cream machine so they can, on a whim, make exotically flavored ice cream one Friday night after baking their own pizza using the portable Pizzeria Pronto oven. And a nonstick muffin tin, too, because although she will not be the kind of dreary mother to slave over a hot stove every day, she will be the kind of woman who might decide to bake muffins once in a while just for fun. So she will have a muffin tin available when and if this should ever happen. They celebrate the completion of their registry checklist by going out to lunch. Over matching Waldorf salads, Khalil says he has a surprise. He says, smiling, that he's contacted a friend at the New York Times who feels confident he can finagle a featured wedding announcement about them. Khalil says this means they will be the subject of a longer article rather than just the blurbs with the headshots they give to everyone else. We're going to be a f***ing feature, he says. Maria asks him why. He looks disappointed in her reaction. I mean, she says, are we interesting enough for a feature? We met in college just like 98% of the other couples in that section. What's so great about us? Khalil leans across the table and whispers to her, we're mulatto. Everybody loves mulattoes. Nobody will ever grow bored of us, ever. He begins to laugh. She laughs too, because it's funny. Every sentence is funnier with the word mulatto in it. After lunch, they look into store windows, holding hands. She glimpses an attractive, smiling couple up ahead. It's them, of course, a reflection in the glass. Maria and Khalil, they look good together. They really do. And she is happy with him. She thinks he's probably right about the article. They will be promoted to a feature story. They're already the subject of a documentary. So what if the sex is not great? Nobody has to see their wooden lovemaking. That doesn't have to be in the feature article about them. They only have to know this vision of them, walking down a street together, laughing. From far away, they look like a couple that would have great sex. It's not that important, sex. The best sex she ever had was with a white guy she despised and fantasized about bludgeoning to death with an African statuette.
Thanks, Danzy. You're up, Jeff.
I'm up. Well, thank you for being here. It's nice to be here in Portland. I'm a little bit taken aback by that reading because it brought to mind the fact that when I got married, we did have a feature article in the Times. Despite the fact that we weren't mulatto, but we were, it was a biracial marriage, and maybe now I realize why we were featured. I thought it was because we were quirky and literary and interesting. But maybe not. We had a wedding cake. I just tell you a little bit about the article. We had a wedding cake that was based on the wedding cake in Madame Bovary, which is, if you've ever read, is a very crazy cake, and we replicated it. And that featured in the article as well. My book is Fresh Complaint. It's a collection of short stories, so there's many different things in it. And I won't explain them all. It does comprise my entire writing life. The earliest story in the book is called Capricious Gardens, and I wrote it as a graduate student when I was about 26 or 27. First thing I ever published. And the most recent work are quite long stories, 50 to 30 pages, that I finished recently. And I'm going to read from one of them, the title story, Fresh Complaint. And this has never appeared anywhere except in this book. It's a long story from two points of view. One is a British physicist, and the other one is an Indian American girl. And this short section is from her point of view. Her name is Prakriti. On the dresser in the master bedroom stood a wedding portrait. In garish color, it showed the boy and girl who would become Prakriti's parents standing solemnly beside each other, as though prodded into position by a goad. Atop her father's impossibly slender face sat a white turban. A diadem depended from her mother's smooth forehead, its gold chain matching the ring in her nose and shadowed by the veil of red lace that covered her hair. Both their necks were draped with heavy necklaces made of multiple strings of shining dark red berries. Or maybe they were too hard to be berries. Maybe they were seeds. On the day the photograph was taken, her parents had known each other for 24 hours. Most of the time, Prakriti didn't think about her parents' wedding. It had happened long ago in another country under different rules. But every now and then, compelled by outrage as much as curiosity, she forced herself to imagine the events immediately following the taking of that photo. A dark, provisionary hotel room somewhere, and standing in the middle of it, her 17-year-old mother. A naive village girl who knew next to nothing about sex or birth control, and yet who knew what was required of her in that particular moment. Understood that it was her duty to take off her clothes in front of a man no less a stranger than someone she passed on the street. To remove her wedding sari, her satin slippers, her hand-sewn underclothes, her gold bangles and necklaces, and to lie on her back and let him do what he wanted. To submit to an accounting student who shared an apartment in Newark, New Jersey, with six other bachelors, his breath still smelling of the American fast food he'd wolfed down before getting on the plane to fly to India. Prockerty couldn't reconcile the scandal of this arrangement. It was almost prostitution, with the prim, autocratic mother she knew. Most probably it hadn't happened like that at all, she decided. More likely nothing had gone on in the first weeks of her parents' marriage, but only much later, once they'd gotten to know each other, and any hint of compulsion or violation had disappeared. Prockerty would never know the truth. She was too scared to ask.
Okay, I'm going to try to talk right into this so you can all hear me. So the theme for today's panel is desperate characters, which I think you can probably tell just based on what you heard read, if you haven't read these books yet, is a pretty apt theme for both books. So I wanted to start by talking just directly about character. What makes a character compelling? I remember in grad school, Zadie Smith was a teacher of mine, and she really railed into a student once for starting a story with just a list of traits that the character, or behaviors the character did, like, he likes coffee, he's left-handed, sometimes he feels sadness when he looks at the snow, like, whatever it was. And she said, that's not character. And for a long time, I thought, like, well, then what is character if it's not these things? So how do you two think about character and what makes a character really come alive?
Well, for me, desperation is a good quality in a character, and the things that you least want for your own self are the things that make the story most alive. So those are places inside of you that you draw on, but you may not want to write about directly. So I tend to think of my characters as a kind of alter ego, a place where I can explore these dangerous spaces in myself, and I want them to have a desire, and I want them to have fears, and I want them to have things they want but can't have. But, you know, the thing I love about fiction is that nothing has to be resolved, and that the character can be, sort of unlikable in so many ways. It's not necessarily the person you want to hang out with or you want to marry, but that if you're inhabiting them fully, there's something really radical about the experience of having to live inside a character without judgment. And so I really like the idea of not judging my characters and allowing them to be deeply flawed and fully embodying them.
Yeah.
I can imagine why Zadie said that that was not characters, just a list of traits of someone, because character usually emerges when characters make decisions or do something because of something that's happening in the story. That's when you know what people are like. It's just as in life, you don't really know your friends or your enemies until you see them do wonderful or terrible things in the world. So that's, I usually tell my students to try to make things change. You know, you don't want stasis. Stasis is the death of fiction. If nothing is happening, if there's no problems, it's a story that begins, Tom lived in Portland. He had a lovely house. His wife June came home. He loved June. His daughter was upstairs, April. She got good grades. You know, it wouldn't be very interesting. Yeah. So I don't think our theme today is desperate characters, and I think every character that any novelist writes about or short story writer is in some desperation, as if we are honest with ourselves, most of us are for long parts of our lives, and at the times when we feel maybe that we'd learn the most, too. I mean, when you tell someone a story, you say, oh, you won't believe what happened to me. This incredible thing happened, and this awful thing was going on, and it begins like that. And that's where drama starts. That's where story starts. So you have to have a problem. Yeah. You really can't write.
Yeah, it reminds me that, like, sort of cliche that we're all... It's not a cliche. It's actually just good writing advice, but that if a character doesn't want something, there's really no story. But in reading both of your books, I thought, like, oh, characters shouldn't just want. They should be, like, desperate to do something totally... totally remarkably surprising and almost like terrifying a little bit. But the range of desperation in Fresh Complaints is really interesting. Like, it might not be something as big as stalking your ex-wife outside of her door when you have a restraining order, but it might be a small decision you make in a bathroom, sort of out of the blue, in which your desperation surprises you, and capturing that is the sort of challenge of the writer. Were you gonna say something, Danzy?
No, I was just gonna say that going off what Jeff was saying about, you know, the happy character not being as interesting, my students will sometimes write a story about potheads, and I'm like, make them drink alcohol instead. They're going to get into a fight if they drink, but if they smoke pot...
Opiates are even worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was asleep again.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
Danzy, there's a quote in an article... a profile that was written about you in Vogue, where you say something that I found very refreshing. I think you just say, the interviewer asks you about trigger warnings, and you say, I want to trigger people. And that's sort of a provocative thing to say, especially in our current moment. And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit. And you too, Jeffrey, because in your stories, pretty much without exception, there's something that could be triggering for someone. That's my trigger warning for all of you. But I'm curious if you think about basically just what you meant and how you think about making the reader uncomfortable, maybe with a little more detail.
What I meant by that was that the stories that I remember and the novels that I remember are ones that kind of disturbed me in some way. And I don't want to feel safe when I'm reading. I want to feel anxious. I want to feel pricked in some way. And so I write toward that, and I write toward... moving away from the sort of sensors in my brain and those sort of moralistic voices telling me what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not. And so, and you know, when I teach, I've taught like a Mary Gateskill story, and it was upsetting to my students. But I think as long as, you know, you're guiding a conversation in which they have a voice to express mm-hmm. those feelings of being triggered or upset, mm-hmm. then that's exactly what literature should be doing. I just don't. My joke with my students was like, you have to kick bell hooks and Judith Butler out of the room if you're going to write fiction. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if anyone knows who they are, but like, you can't. Those were theorists in college who had a big influence on me in terms of feminism and racial consciousness, but I found when I sat down to write fiction, they were extremely unhelpful mm-hmm. in telling me what I was allowed to say and what was problematic.
I can only echo that. When you're trying to write, you go into a place where you try not to think about anything that limits your imagination or your freedom or your capacity to try something in a story. And when you feel that's happening, you have to resist it. It's more difficult now than ever for any generation of writers. People can respond now to complaints or things they don't like about your work in real time. And if you were the kind of writer that was on Twitter and was watching that all the time, I'm sure it would have a deleterious effect on one's writing. So you have to kind of protect yourself more than ever. It used to be quite easy, you know, but now it's less easy.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that readers are more sensitive to certain subjects in fiction now than maybe in the past? Or do you think that social media and all of these different avenues we have for kind of like sharing our opinion with the world just makes it feel that way?
It's like with everything, the people that are upset are the ones you're going to hear about. The ones that liked it quietly on
it's
an
like
afternoon
Yelp.
Aren't going to say anything about it. And you know they're there, you know, because mm-hmm. you meet them. At other times. So I don't know, there's maybe people are a little bit more touchy now, but they're just able to get their voices. I mean, there's lots of good sides of that as well,
yeah.
but not when you're writing and you're trying, you know, you just don't think about these things. You're thinking about your story and what happened, in it, and what would the people do, and does this seem real? Does this seem authentic? And once you change that to have an outcome that's more palatable but less true, then the story gets worse.
Right.
Did you have an experience where, when you wrote your first book, did it take a long time to get the praise that was heaped on it out of your head? I'm just curious if praise was also sort of...
Don't you just remember dispraise and the praise is, always falls away? You just remember the one bad thing they said.
Yeah, you always remember the one bad line, but yeah. I was just curious because you were young and sort of had this amazing debut novel, and I was speaking from my experience of having sort of being told... Well, I was asking that because I was sort of had, before I really knew what it was to be a writer, I became an author. Mm-hmm. And the relationship between being an author and a writer, like they're very separate things
right.
you're doing when you're just talking about your work and promoting it. So it took me many years to kind of become a writer after my first book came out.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
It does make sense. I think you have to do things, the whole idea of the author. I mean, we're an author at this moment because we're sitting here being official and talking about our work.
Right.
So it does happen. But most of the time, I'm in a room, and I feel exactly the way I did when I started writing. In fact, for a while, I had a nice writing studio. I bought this nice house, and it had a glass studio and a garden, and it's the perfect place. Like if they took a photo of the writer at work, this would be the best place I could
right.
sit. I
would
really
go along
look
with
like
the
a
feature.
Writer, and I could not write there because it was so nice and. You know, the flowers were outside, and the gardener would appear, and I would watch the gardener. And I had to go, so I finally went up into the attic to this decrepit room that made me remember what it was like to write in grad school, you know, when the heat didn't work. And that's where I work. I work in this terrible little room because that's where I'm a writer. And I never want it to be nice at
yeah.
all. So, right, an author has a nice room, but a writer has a bad room.
Yes.
What happened to the room? What is it used for now? The nice room.
The nice room, well, we finally sold the house. Now it's being used by someone who can enjoy it.
By an author,
yeah.
probably.
Somebody else. It's probably like a yoga room now.
Yeah. That sounds like especially pleasant.
Right.
Danzy, you said something about authenticity, or I think both of you did actually, in talking about characters that feel real, and sometimes that means exploring the darker, more uncomfortable sides of them. I'm really interested in Maria, and I think I've heard you get asked this question before, so I'm sorry to do it to you again, but like, Maria she's not traditionally likable. I found her fascinating and utterly compelling and impossible to stop reading her story, but were you ever concerned, it sounds like the answer is no, but do you have concern about how far the reader is willing to go with you when you push your characters to these extreme places? Are you ever like, okay, readers are really going to find this one like hard to take, or like, what if she's too much, or is that just not kind of part of your conceptualization of the work?
Yeah, I mean, I never, when I read a novel, and then my favorite novels, the characters weren't likable, they weren't like me, they were interesting. Mm-hmm. And I never found Maria uninteresting. You know, she stalks someone while she's engaged to be married, she shakes a baby, she does things that are...
That's kind of like the low, like not the worst.
No, I gave a reading, yeah, that's not, I'm not giving away the worst stuff. What's the worst stuff?
I don't know.
Little baby shake.
The baby shaking's not the worst thing she does? Okay.
Okay, that's pretty bad.
No, but I gave a reading in D.C. and this guy asked me, do you like babies? And it was like this idea that I don't have an imagination that can go to places that, you know, aren't me,
yeah.
but also that all of us have been irritated by the sound of a baby screaming,
yeah.
and
yeah.
all of us have been obsessed, and all of us have done things or thought things that were shameful. So, I mean, I think we're living in a very self-righteous moment, and that's actually not helpful at all for writing mm-hmm. fiction. Like, you know, this idea that any of us is pure. To me, the things that make a character sort of paradoxically, the thing that on the page makes a character universally recognizable is the thing that in real life makes you the most lonely and the most alienated and isolated. So For me to go to a character who is sort of losing her mind with obsession and dissatisfaction and not able to finish this dissertation on the Jonestown massacre, which would drive anyone insane, you know, that for me is a place to go to somewhere that people will relate to if they're honest with themselves, you know.
I feel similarly when there's some kind of disconnect in my mind when I'm writing a character, and if a reader seems to hate the character, really disapprove of the character, sometimes I'm surprised, and my first reaction is maybe not a generous one. I think, not a very good reader, you know.
Mm-hmm. I don't like you.
Doesn't really, you know, there's much more to that character than that. But then there's other times when I think about it, and I realize that some of the characters I've loved in literature are flawed, but there's some sort of goodness to them that makes me really like them, root for them, share their experience more readily, maybe even want to be them to a certain extent. And I can't deny that that's a huge part of literature, and I shouldn't just willfully decide that my writer should not be appealing on some level. So I wonder about it if I've been too, I don't know, doctrinaire in my ideas that my characters can be awful, even though some of them are. And I don't even notice when they are. That just seems interesting. As Danzy said, sometimes it just seems what's interesting about the story is their bad behavior and what's brought them to it. So I don't know, but I wrestle with it still.
Yeah, I mean, Amy Hempel said in an interview that, you know, fiction is logical, and if there's not a logic to their bad behavior, that's when it becomes less interesting to me. But I think that, you know, characters can do, often you can push your character really to doing things that are really awful, and sometimes if it's funny, people will be willing to go there for a lot longer.
Oh, if it's
longer.
Funny, you can really make them do horrible things.
Yeah. If they're funny or the story is funny.
No, yeah. I only do horrible with funny. I never separate the two. Yeah.
I mean, it also, there's something funny about desperation. Like in both of these books, when these characters are doing these things that are, sometimes you're worried for them, often you feel tenderness towards them, but the more desperate they get, the kind of more comical they are. And you're both very funny writers. I'm curious, sort of selfishly, how you pull that off, and whether you think about comic timing, or like making a joke, or pushing a character to do something in an absurd way as like a strategy, or if it's more intuitive at this point.
I'm trying to go against comedy in my recent work, because I've always had an easier time being funny. In life, how I navigate life is to make jokes. Socially, that's how I get by, cover, you know, nervousness and shyness, make jokes. I'll be the guy that won't say anything, then the zinger will come in, and that's how I've dealt with life. And so I can do it in stories, but it's the same principle. I'm sometimes evading the emotion that's going on, or a certain depth that's claimable. And in some of the new stories, the first story in this collection is called Complainers, and it's the quietest, least funny story I've ever written. It has moments of humor in it, nevertheless, but I tried to resist the American sitcom reflex that I think is pervading a lot of contemporary fiction. It's not that there shouldn't be humor, but the idea that there's a joke or the line is in there to get a laugh from the audience, it's reassuring if you're doing a public reading, but it actually detracts from the reading experience, which finally draws you in. If you read an Alice Munro story, there are moments of humor, but you don't feel her trying to crack a joke, and because of that, you do get to a different level with the characters, and the simulated reality becomes more encompassing. You're not reminded of the writer's wit all the time.
Yeah, and I also think that I agree with that, and that the funniest work for me, that comedy is interesting to me when it's undercut with rage or sadness, that's the most interesting humor for me, is that which is kind of, there's anxiety and anger and sadness within that. And so for me, humor is not, the zinger or the sitcom writing is not kind of what I am most interested in, but the kind of ways that humor can be a cover for all sorts of other feelings. And my favorite comedians, you know, have all of these layers to their humor.
Yeah. Right. You're sometimes like scared or sad at the same time that you're also like laughing your ass off. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask Danzy one question that came up. I like this idea that fiction is logical. Did you say Amy Hempel said that?
Yeah.
Because it is. I'm always telling my students, it's you're stating a premise in a story and you're following it through. There's a kind of argumentation that goes on in writing fiction that a lot of writers don't think about, especially student writers. They think, I write essays for class. I use my rational side of my brain, but not here. I'm just going to go into this dreamy state. And it's a combination of those things. There's a lot of logic in fiction. Things have to be logical. So.
Yeah, and like the idea of causality, I think, that something happens because something else just happened. That's something that they have to be reminded of. And I have a 9-year-old who will tell me a story and it has no logic to it, and it goes on and on, and then and then and then, and it's just whatever comes into his head. And I have to like rein in my...
I think he's in my workshop right now.
I have to like rein in the fiction teacher and the fiction writer to be editing his stories and be like, that's, you know, and be the mother then and indulge it. But it can be, you know, it's really boring after a while. Right. Gotta say.
Right, just give him a shake.
Yeah.
That was the zinger. That was the
zinger.
That was the zinger.
No problem.
You were waiting for it. So I want to ask another kind of nuts and boltsy question a little bit. So Jeffrey, I might be getting this wrong, but I don't think, maybe I am. But I think all of your books are written in like a flexible close third, or except Virgin Suicide, which is more of a choral.
They're all different. Virgin Suicides is a first person plural.
Right.
We voice a choral narrator. You can't tell who it is. It's group of middle-aged men recalling their adolescence. Middlesex is a first-person narrator endowed with a measure of third-person omniscience, impossibly. And the marriage plot is three different points of view, close third for each of them. And then this book is a mixture of all four of those things, all three of those things.
I wonder, is there a story written in first in Freshman
Lights? First, there's a lot of first. There's actually no first plural.
And Danzy, there's a certain distance. I guess basically what I'm getting at by asking that question in like a weirdly quizzing way is just that there's this kind of distance or remove I notice in both of these books in terms of sometimes it's very close in the characters and sometimes it feels a little farther away, but we don't often get these intimate, like, I feel this way, you know, monologuing kind of thing. And I wonder if there's... It struck me that perhaps there's a relationship between watching characters do uncomfortable things and having a measure of authorial remove from it in describing it. Or like we're watching Maria watch things, or we're watching her in the apartment say, we're kind of with her, but we're also with you, sort of. Maybe that's too abstract of a question, but is it easier to write more uncomfortable moments with a measure of remove, or it's all hard? And
well, I just think that the reader, the beauty of fiction is the reader wants to do some of the work. And so if you fill in too much explicitly, that work of the reader has been stolen from them. And so I like work that leaves something out, and things are implied or gestured at. But with this book, in a way, it was like an experiment in coldness. Yeah. And I found when I would write a scene, and I could see the sort of sentimental resolution that I could, or maybe not even sentimental, but just the resolution of the anxiety or the problem, I just really wanted to withhold that and keep the anxiety alive in this book. And so I was kind of always striving toward a certain coldness in this book, and kind of as a experiment in some ways, but one, I knew what kind of book, you're always kind of writing the book you want to read, and that was what I've been reading a lot of. So the sort of slightly withholding.
What were you reading that you think is like that?
I read Ketsey's Disgrace and The Stranger, and there were a lot of short novels too that I was just really, I liked that perspective where you're almost looking at a case study of a character, and you were also inhabiting them at the same time.
Yeah, it feels like that. It's kind of a trick. You're like, you, sometimes you're so with her, and then suddenly you're watching her. I was fascinated by that. And I sense some of that play with distance and space and Fresh Complaints as well, but I wondered if it had... I think some of these questions are hard, ultimately. It is.
They're hard. Sometimes you want a third-person voice to protect you. It's not... You know it's not you, and you can make the character do things that you don't want attached to you. But as a writer, you can't worry about that. I was walking over here with my publisher, and as men of a certain age do, we got to talking about our prostate glands. And... And I remembered, I brought up this, one of my favorite things in the recent Philip Roth books, when Nathan Zuckerman gets older, he has prostate cancer and has surgery and has to wear a diaper. So Nathan Zuckerman wears diapers in the last three books. And this is, as far as I know, not true of Philip Roth himself, but that character is an alter ego. And there's something so daring about that. The books are not about that. He's writing about other people, but then now and then he'll bring this fact in, this physical discomfort and shame that he has and the tribulations that are connected to it. And you need to be able to do that as a writer, just not worry what people think about you. You have to say, I'm wearing a diaper now, in a sense, all the time when you're writing, if it's required for the story, and just not worry, do they think I have a diaper on or not? You know, you can't worry about that, and you have to have a chip missing in your head that allows you to do that.
Yeah. I feel like if somebody didn't tweet that with a PDX book festival hashtag, that's the quote for this entire panel.
It's going to be on the tote bag next year.
I'm going to make sure that...
It'll be nice.
It's going to be on my Twitter in 35 minutes. I'm just going to ask a couple more questions, and then I'm going to open it up to the people in the audience. Just giving you warning now so you can think about what those questions might be. Both of you touched on this a little bit, but I want to push a little bit more because I'd like some reading recommendations. So what were the influences, maybe more specifically, Danzy, you talked about this a little bit, but on these books, and I mean, I guess for you, Jeffrey, that's really like on your whole career, since this is a sort of a career-spanning collection, the writers that influenced you more than anyone else.
It changes depending, since this is a career-spanning book, the writers have changed over time. The earliest story was influenced, I can feel the influence of Central European writers like Robert Musil and Hermann Brock and Milan Kundera. It's a kind of distance, playful, analytical narrative, almost as though the characters are not quite real but are ideas to a certain degree. There are other stories I can feel J.D. Salinger in them, Saul Bellow, and you know, Alice Munro, different people depending on what I was reading and thinking about and what I was learning, needing to learn at different points in my life.
Did you revise the stories in compiling them for the collection, or did you
them be what they were. I made a couple of changes to a name and things like that, but they're the same. I didn't try to bring them up. I mean, it would be impossible. I'm a different writer now than I was then, so I couldn't bring it into what I do now.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, I love Evelyn Waugh and the sort of bitchy British satirist voice, the coldness of that. Nella Larsen, I think, is just brilliant and does these very short, sharp, and sort of deeply dangerous books about women. Patricia Highsmith was an influence, I would say. I was really wanting to write a predatory female character, sort of going against some of what I felt like I kept reading. And I'm always interested in writing the book that I haven't read yet. So that was kind of what interested me here.
Yeah, it feels radical, actually, how predatory she is. I can't think of an example of anything in like recent contemporary fiction, at least, that with a character that feels like Maria.
I have a virtuously predatorial female in one of my stories. So we're on the same. Right?
Yeah, that's true.
I do.
Yeah,
not to give it away.
That's very true. In Fresh Complaints, the last.
Yeah, a little
in the collection.
Bit. Yeah, try to turn the tables there a bit. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so there are two.
Now we need to change the theme.
Someone else needs to write one. So I think if anybody else in the audience has any questions, I can, we have one right here.
Hi, thank you both for coming. I have a question again for Mr. Eugenides. I saw a lot of your characters acting on emotional desperation, and I'm just curious as a writer as to how you put yourself in that place, because I think emotional desperation is a lot harder to predict the actions that are going to happen right after, as opposed to when somebody makes a rational choice. And I'm just curious as to how you put yourself there for characters that are so, so different from yourself.
I usually try to find some connection in my own life to the character I'm writing about. And if I can't find that, I usually can't write the story. So with Middlesex, I'm writing from the point of view of an intersex person, someone born female who becomes male at puberty and adopts a different gender identity. So I have reasons in my psychology and in my biography that attuned me to that experience and made me think about that a lot. And I just tried to use the little bit that I know to get into the head of someone who'd lived a different life than mine. That's what I always do. There's always some kind of connection. It's usually I just exaggerate the things that I feel until it accords with someone else's experience. If I can't find that connection, if I can't feel, it's almost like acting the part, like a method actor. You try to use your own sense experience and the things that you know in order to play somebody else. So it feels like acting more than anything else. And you're right, it's emotional. It's not that in that respect, it's not logical, analytical at all. You need to feel what the other people felt. So just for an example, I was a late bloomer. I went through puberty only a few years ago, if you really want to know. And it was very embarrassing in high school to be the only person who was prepubescent. In fact, the word prepubescent used to reduce me to tears if anyone said it, because I did not want to be that, and I was. So I had terrible times on the football team. I'm the kid that wore his pads home. I refused to shower in the locker room for years. There's a lot of anxiety about that. And I use that for my character, who is also going through traumatic feelings in the locker room for very different reasons. But emotionally, it's actually not that different what I went through. So that's the kind of thing I'll do. I'll find something that I know intimately, and I'll redirect it to a different destination.
That sounds a little bit like what you were saying before, Dancy, about alter ego, kind of.
Yeah, like I always say, I look for the story that didn't happen within the story that did, and I'm not interested in something that I can't find any point of identification with, but I'm also not interested in sticking to that. I want to find the place where I can depart in terms of the story to a place that I don't know as well. So both things, yeah. Yeah.
When I talk about this question of appropriation and everything, where I worry about that is not what I'm allowed to write or what I can't write. I have an interior sensor that tells me what I can write and what I can't. There's many, many places I can't go.
Yeah.
And sometimes if I can find a way, I'll write from anyone's point of view, but it's not just indiscriminate, you know, noblesse oblige, I'm just going to do it. I can't. I'll know if I can do it or not.
I have a two-part question. The first one is for both of you, actually. What are your fears when you guys are writing, and how do you guys handle writer's block?
We have writer's block answering the question.
Yeah. You both looked kind of stunned.
I got depressed. The question that sent me into a spiral. No, I... I just sort of slumped when he said that. I mean, the fear is for me that I won't be able to kind of sustain the dream state I want to be in, and that I'll be sort of woken up from it and see what an insane and foolish thing I'm doing. So I'm always trying to kind of find ways to filter and, you know, write toward that private space of amusement, like amusing myself alone in a room is what I want to go for, and not thinking about audience. I have a writing group of four women writer friends who I sort of think of them as my audience, and if I can make them excited about what I'm writing, then that's enough for me. But
how often do you give stuff to them?
Probably every 6 weeks we you know, one of us will, or two of us.
Do you meet in person, or you just send it?
Meet in person. Writer's block, I mean, it's just that you have not sat down and forced yourself to write, because it is such a horrible thing to do, writing. And, you know, it isn't, like, it's often really, really unpleasant. So I do think that discipline and the forcing yourself to get to that place of just writing every day and writing through that is the only way to get past it. But, you know, it's like the Samuel Beckett, fail better. Like, the novel and the story are never going to be what I'm hoping they're going to be. But so accepting a certain level of failure is also part of it for me.
Yeah, I work with a lot of anxiety and doubt all the time, and I'm trying to learn still, having done this for a while now, just to let those negative ideas flow away from me. Actually, my therapist told me to do this. They're not really you. Like, you get into this head for a while that the writing is terrible and you're never going to write anything good again, and you think these awful things, and that's going to happen to you. It's impossible to write without thinking that sometimes. You just have to not let it attach to you too much. John Barth said that writing is the experience of going from overweening self-confidence to utter despair. And you can do that in a day. You know, you can just think that you're the greatest writer and the worst writer within the span of a couple of hours. Yeah. So it's a difficult thing.
I wasn't able to write in New York, and I've only ever finished books in L.A., so I live in L.A. now, and it's sort of this strangely, like,
you're... It's better if no one's reading where you
live. Well, that's the thing. No, you're like the Amish or something. If you go to a party, people are like, you do what? To be optioned, you know, why are you doing this? So I find that sort of liberating, the sense that nobody cares what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And L.A. has been great for that. Yeah.
That's it. I used to live in Berlin, and I had the same feeling when I would get there, there would be this peacefulness, because no one knew, no one was even speaking English, you know, so it was fine. It was fine. Yeah.
You had your hand up right there with the glasses. Yeah, I think we have time to get to yours really quickly.
Why did you want to become a writer? Like, what was your inspiration for becoming an author?
Yes. Did you hear that, Danzy? What was your inspiration for becoming a writer?
I'm trying to remember.
It's a perfect question to end on.
I'm going to guess you were probably good at it and you liked doing it.
Yeah, I started writing at a very young age and would read these stories and a novel I wrote when I was 11 out loud in serial drafts to my family. I just was a voracious reader and loved the sort of experience of leaving this world and going somewhere else. And it seemed like a kind of magic that I wanted to do myself. And I really liked thinking of myself in the third person. and sort of one of the most amazing things was that anything that happens to you as a writer, it can be horrible, but it all is material. So there's nothing wasted. And that was kind of, in a ruthless way, a reason to become a writer. Yeah.
There's one story in my collection called Airmail, and it's about a young college kid who takes a year off. He ends up in Thailand, and he writes airmail letters home to his parents, as you did in those days. And I did that myself, and in the same way, I always wrote about myself in the third person in my journal. I never had a normal journal. I had this character named Thomas who would do all the things that I did, or other things, you know, and it was kind of Thomas did this, Thomas did that. It seemed very dramatic to me to write that way. And then it would kind of slip into my letters home, and I would send them to my parents, and I would write crazy stuff in the letters as though it was my experience, and it was a bit, but he was... So I would write sentences like, sometimes I feel the flutter of angelic wings against my face, was one sentence that I sent. And my parents thought I'd become a religious fanatic or something. And I sort of had, but not really. But in the letter, I really had. So I think maybe that's why we became writers. We just can't really... Our imagination is what we're more interested in than our actual life. So we just kind of start making this stuff up, and what other career could we, what else could we do at that point?
There's no, there's nothing else for people like that. Thank you all so much. The authors will be signing books.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a conversation between Jeffrey Eugenides and Danzy Senna at an event recorded at Wordstock, Portland's book festival in 2017. The event was moderated by Julie Button. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.